Hello, and welcome to the Theater of the Absurd, Legends of Philadelphia. These are your hosts, Johnny Zito and his best friend, Tony Trove. I'm Brian Bierman, helping out on engineering duties. You might be asking, what type of nonsense is this? Well, in addition to being Philadelphia natives, Tony Trove and Johnny Zito have a little t-shirt business. South Philly. That focuses on Philly culture and intrigue. Lots of time, customers will ask us, what's the difference between East and West Passion? You don't want to get lost. I've done that. Or they want to know where the closest Mac machine is. The closest one is in 1998. So we decided to start this podcast as an easy explainer for new Philadelphians and a refresher for the old heads. The city fascinates and excites us, so we're hoping to share that with you.
Mac machine. Why do you always talk shit on my sound effects, dude? This is their analog special effects.
Sound effects.
Going, they're from the 90s. All right.
Sounds like a soundboard.
No, we need. I know we need a real sound.
They're professional quality. It's definitely like the guy from Police Academy. I feel like I'm listening to it off of the actual machine.
Let's get Michael Winslow to read the intro. He's on Cameo.
Is he?
All these celebrities at your fingertips.
Yeah. What about the Micro Machine guy? Is he on there?
He's probably dead.
Oh.
He always say that.
That's a bummer. I'm sorry I brought it up.
Speaking of special sound effects, special announcement.
Do you think, I don't know, has anyone realized that you've been using the KYW ticker for the background of the news segment now?
No one has mentioned it, but that is what the sound is. It's straight from the source, straight from the KYW.
They're not using it anymore.
Got the ticker machine back here. I press it as fast as I can. And,
yeah, one person's trash is another person's treasure.
Yes.
You know? Yeah.
We'll take your ticker.
One radio show's trash is another podcast treasure.
You don't want this? That's what I said. Yo, you don't want this? Can I have it? Now it's ours. So, a special announcement. Memorial Day sale. Cheap things, ugly things, good-looking things. We'll save this bump and we'll use it for in the summer too. All right, that's it. The special announcement's over. I like special announcements. You know, it's we pretend it's news, but it's actually always an ad. But that's how real news works. That's how the real news works.
Yeah, it's KYW is an ad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. KYW is an ad.
The other day I was walking on Delaware Ave and I saw a sign that was near the bike lane because they are building a bike lane and it was closed off and there was a sign.
And you're on foot.
Yeah, I'm on foot.
You don't ride a bike.
No, I don't. And I never driven a car. So so I walked up to the sign and I was like, there's all this writing on it. So I'm like, what is this? So I walk up to it and someone wrote, hey, fuck you for fucking us out of a bike lane. And then in a different handwriting next to it, it says, hi, we are making you a new bike lane, ball bag. So, that's somebody who works with. And then I guess the guy came back or whoever came back the next day and they wrote, shit, I was drunk. I'm sorry. And thank you. Very Philadelphia.
That's great.
Owning up to it. That's saying you're sorry. Takes a lot to say you're sorry.
Takes a lot. Especially after someone calls you a ball bag.
I don't say I'm sorry, though.
That guy had it coming. He was being a ball bag.
He was being a ball bag. At least he owned it.
Well, I guess Philadelphia's a tough place.
Speaking of ball bags. It's such a vulgar and not vulgar thing to say. It's perfect.
Yeah, it's a good PG-13 insult. Okay, we're just going to jump into today's episode, today's topic. That was pretty abstract. That was pretty surreal. So we're just going to jump right into it. The master of absurdity, absurd filmmaking, David Lynch. David Lynch is an American filmmaker and screenwriter who's best known for his uniquely disturbing and mind-bending visual work. He has developed his own unique cinematic style, which he has dubbed Lynchian, and is characterized by dreamy juxtaposition.
I know just the thing to call it.
Which is characterized by dreamy juxtaposition of the cheerfully mundane and the shockingly macabre that often defies explanation. And the time he spent in Philly was his biggest inspiration. So settle in as we take a surreal tour through David Lynch's Philadelphia.
Settle in.
Settle in for more disturbing,
surreal tales. If you're standing, please sit.
Yeah, sit down. You're going to need to sit down.
If you're driving, please pull over.
Yeah.
But don't stop listening. Pull over until we're done.
Yeah, we need your full attention.
Yeah. Stop eating your breakfast. Spit that out. That's why I say my dog.
Do you guys have any David Lynch stories? Do you remember learning about David Lynch going to school in Philadelphia? Was this something you knew before recently?
I guess when people would say Eraserheadville as a section of Philadelphia, it made me aware of that David Lynch had a connection to the city, but I don't have
Eraserhood.
Yeah, that's it. But I never did karaoke with the guy or anything. I mean, I don't have any. I don't know the guy. I'm just no. My story is weak. I'm sorry. I don't have any good ones.
What about Bierman? Do you know of David Lynch? Were you a fan or familiar with David Lynch before this?
Yeah, I was a fan of him. Like growing up. And reading about movies and weird movies, and then he directed Blue Velvet, and then he rent Blue Velvet, and you're like, wow, this is fucked up. And then it's like Eraserhead is like, I knew that was like his Philly movie, and maybe that's why I love it so much, because I've watched it a few times, and it's like really, it's very weird, but it's really funny, and I think people, I don't know, it's not. It's more accessible. It is weird, but it's not. It's more accessible than I think people think. It's very funny. It's very weird, though.
Yeah, it's super weird. When I was in film school, we had to watch Eraserhead, and the professor told us that that Lynch was inspired by the area around 12th and Spring Garden, 11th and Spring Garden, and where the old railroads meet the factories and the power plants. And then we watched it, and I was blown away because it really did feel like that neighborhood, but they didn't shoot it here. So he went and, scouted and found specific locations, I guess, in L.A. to elicit that feel of the neighborhood that he grew or lived in while he was here in Philadelphia.
It's like they're in a train yard, and it's just, weird industrial noises and just, it's like always super loud, and it's like, oh, I know this.
Yeah, it's very disorienting.
And he did Twin Peaks, probably his biggest thing.
Oh yeah, Twin Peaks. I guess that's part of that. Go ahead, Jeff.
I shouldn't. Don't admit it, but I always loved his when he was on Louie, and he was kind of like the late night host.
He was great.
That's my favorite David Lynch. I think that's when he's actually funny.
Yeah, David Lynch can be really funny. He's on Family Guy and things like that. He has great comedic timing.
Really?
Yeah, doesn't he do his own voice on Family Guy?
I don't know.
Oh, I don't know.
Oh, maybe we'll have to cut that out, but I'm pretty sure he does. Yeah, I guess this whole episode is really because I just did a rewatch of Twin Peaks. I saw it years ago. It was on Bravo. It was rerun on Bravo, but now with Netflix and whatnot and the new season
that
came
Bravo.
Out. Yeah, that's where the Log Lady intros and outros come from.
Okay.
Yeah,
so
they
Bravo
were part of the original broadcast.
Different.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if I was in high school or college, but I remember watching it.
Now it's cable. Just like rich assholes on a yacht is all Bravo shows. Or people throwing wine in each other's faces.
Is it? I haven't...
Yeah, Bravo is just like straight up trash reality TV, like 24/7.
Wow, no, yeah, I guess back then they were showing the syndication
of
Twin Peaks.
They were artsier.
If we all recorded in the same room like we used to, I'd probably throw a drink on both of you.
Just because
I throw it on the iPad, mm-hmm. But it's not the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
not the same effect.
Yeah, so I flick the screen when I talk to you guys. You just don't realize it.
It doesn't hurt.
Yeah, so I did a rewatch of Twin Peaks, and it reignited my interest in David Lynch. And so I went to the wiki page, and I didn't realize how much was actually there about his time in Philadelphia. It's pretty well documented. And then years ago, he came back to Philadelphia in like 2014, and he did a bunch of press, and so there's a lot of like quotes from that event about how much he loves Philadelphia and what his experience was like here. So we're pulling a lot from that and an article, a Vice article by Jake Blumgart. So most of this came from Wiki, but a lot of the David Lynch quotes from the live event come from this Vice article, and we'll link to that in the Visual Companion. David Lynch was born in Missoula, Montana, on January 20th, 1946. He wasn't a very good student. He hated school. Lynch said it destroyed the seeds of liberty, and the teachers didn't encourage knowledge or a positive attitude, just conformity. After leaving, he decided that he wanted to study painting at college. He began his studies in Washington, D.C. before transferring to the School of the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, where he was roommates with musician Peter Wolfe, the guy who wrote or performed, I don't know if he wrote it, Ain't My Angel Is a Centerfold.
Oh, Jay Giles Band.
Oh, yeah. What a weird group.
Weird
what
crossover.
A weird two people.
Yeah. Lynch left after only a year, saying he was not inspired at all by school in Boston. Instead, he decided that he wanted to travel around Europe for 3 years. He had some hopes that he could train in Europe with Austrian expressionist painter Oskar Kokoschka at his school. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that. I'm really sorry.
No, I think it sounds like you nailed it.
No, I'm doing it phonetically, but there's a lot of K's in there.
Kokoschka.
Kokoschka?
I don't know.
No, I think you might have gotten closer than I did. Upon reaching South
Kokosha.
Kokosha. Ka.
Kokosha. Ka.
I'm doing my best. Upon reaching Salzburg, however, they found that the school was closed. Disillusioned, Lynch returned to the United States after spending only 2 weeks in Europe.
Should have called ahead.
So yeah, I guess he had this idea that he was going to go to some, you know, weird Eastern European place and study expressionism, like, you know, old timey German art films or whatever. And he didn't find that for him in Europe. Instead, he came back to the United States, and Lynch decided to move to Philadelphia and enroll at the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts, the next best thing. He preferred this college to his previous school in Boston, saying, quote, "In Philadelphia, there were great and serious painters, and everybody was inspiring one another, and it was a beautiful time there," end quote.
Nice.
Yeah, so I guess he found his people, his other like-minded artists or whatever in the city.
Weirdos.
Weirdos, if you will.
Weird long hairs, weirdos.
Yeah. I got to do an after-school program at PAFA when I was in high school. It's a beautiful place. It's got lots of like statues and sculptures and things. So many so that they're like locked away in the basement for students to sketch, and then they have stuff that's on display. And it's a great place to visit. It's where the giant paintbrush and the dab of paint that kind of looks like poo is.
Looks like dog poop.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, the dog poop.
Yes. You should have just said that.
Yeah. Yeah. Kid has it turned it into a dog poo emoji a couple years ago, and now I can't unsee it. It was at PAFA that Lynch began a relationship with fellow student Peggy Reavy, whom he married in 1967 while here in Philadelphia. While you worked at Marriage License Trove, I wish we knew this. We could have looked up to David Lynch's marriage license.
Should have done it, yeah. Let's go.
Sure, it's very weird.
The following year, Peggy gave birth to their daughter, Jennifer. Peggy later said Lynch was a reluctant father, but a very loving one. As a family, they moved to Philadelphia's Fairmount neighborhood, where they bought a 12-room house for the relatively low price of $3,500 due to the area's wow. high crime and poverty rates. Yeah, $3,500. Yeah, you want to look up how much that is nowadays?
For a 12-room house?
For a 12-room house, it's going to be a steal no matter what. But I mean, also where this 12-room house is in Fairmount and at the time and what condition it's in, I don't know. But I looked it up because it went on sale, I think, in like 2014 for much more than $3,500. And it was totally rehabbed, and it's sunny and beautiful, and it's kind of hard to imagine, you know, the city that that Lynch was living in, the Philadelphia that Lynch was living in back then, and compared to what it looks like now, it's like a sunny dream home.
Maybe he was just exaggerating. You know, like in my day,
$3,500 and 67 is worth $27,984 and 70 cents today.
Steal.
You can't even buy an empty lot in the city of Philadelphia for less than $150,000 to get something for. Would you say it was 27,000?
Yeah,
that's still insane.
Yeah, you should have sat on it.
$27,000. David Lynch later said, quote, "We lived cheap, but the city was full of fear. A kid was shot to death down the street. We were robbed twice, had windows shot out, and a car stolen. The house was first broken into only 3 days after we moved in. The feeling was so close to extreme danger, and the fear was so intense. There was violence and hate and filth, but the biggest influence on my whole life was that city," end quote.
Damn.
Made quite an impact on him.
He was like, this place is a nightmare. I love it.
I guess.
Yeah, essentially, he moved in and he was like, this place is the complete opposite of everywhere I've been. It's exactly what I'm looking for. And he kind of just like totally immersed himself in the feel of the city. Lynch first lived on 13th and Wood in Callow Hill, across from the old city morgue, only 4 blocks from Paffa, so he could walk back and forth to school. The area was composed of old industrial buildings, the occasional line of well-kept row homes, and a few small eateries catering to local workers in the area. I always remember across the street from the Inquirer building, which is real close to this as well, there was like a train car converted into like a diner and eatery, and it was like...
Oh, yeah.
So I imagine like a bunch of places like that, a bunch of... What do you call them? Grease pits?
Greasy spoons?
Greasy spoons. Grease pit is totally unappetizing.
So is greasy spoon.
There's a place called the Grease Pit in Philadelphia. I'll tell you about it later.
Okay. You need a password to get it.
Yeah. Give me a ride.
I'm coming over. Before the Clean Air Act, the remaining factories in the area spewed smoke over the city, much to the director's delight. Lynch recalls, quote, "All the buildings were black, soot-covered, very pure, very filthy. It had a beautiful mood." This is all, again, from that press conference in 2014 at PAFA, describing what the neighborhood used to look like.
I remember when City Hall had like that soot all over. That's when they started cleaning. I don't know when they cleaned it.
I mean, it felt like it started in like 2001 or 2002, and it took them almost like 15 years.
Well, they,
to get
remember
it done.
They remember they painted it first. They like remember it was like another color, and then they well,
the ends, yeah, the end caps, yeah, they did, the and then cap. they spray
painted it first,
and
then they painted it that city mint color, and then...
You know, it's so funny you're bringing that up because that's another thing Lynch talks about. I didn't pull the quote exactly, but one of the things he brings up at the PAFA lectures or discussions. Is that the whole city was painted that weird mint green at the time.
Did
no matter
he really
where
bring
you
that
went.
Up?
Yeah. He said he talks about it.
That,
it's like, in the subways and every city building, every elevator door.
Yeah, it's like in the public schools and in City Hall. It's a... I'm telling you, Wilson Good was like, "Give me how much?"
Well, this predates even that.
Give me as much as you got. Yeah, right.
This might go all the way back to when they built these places, like in 1925, and when all the schools and the hospitals were being built.
Wow.
But yeah, I didn't pull the quote. But yeah, he specifically mentions that as well. That's the Philadelphia he's living in, and I think it's really interesting that he describes the buildings as being pure because they were covered in soot. It made them all one color. They're all black. They're all like, you know, the same
uniform. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I don't know. We hung out even a couple of years ago. We hung out at bars in that area, and not much has changed. There's still a giant power plant under the trestle. Road, yeah, and the JJ Trestle Inn, yeah, all these things from 1966 are still there.
Sure. Now it's a weird spot of the city because it's kind of like the edge of Chinatown. It's like Chinatown, the highway, this, and then like true North Philly.
Yeah, and then there's like a bunch of like because there's a bunch of factories around there. Like the Inquirer building is there, and like they used to do their printing across the street. You know,
right.
So it's like a bunch of like industrial factory, you know, style buildings like that, and like row homes tucked in between, that are like kind of like built between these big warehouses and things.
And Crown Fried Chicken.
I'm sure there was at least one. And then you got to imagine, I don't know how late the, I wish I had looked this up, but there's also the railroad line there. So every day the railroad line is coming through, spewing its own noise and soot all over the neighborhood as well. So Philly was deteriorating, you know, both physically and socioeconomically, and the conditions made their impression on the director. Yeah. Something to get excited about. We talk about a lot of this in the South Street episode, and I guess part two, when we talk about the riots and things like that. There's a lot of like, the city is changing. It's becoming less industrial at the time, and so there's like people are losing jobs, people are leaving the city. So the during this time here, the fiercely racialized competition for diminishing jobs and city services made the city a powder keg. Also threatening to explode at any moment. So, like, you know, David Lynch is living in this town where it feels like a fight could break out at any time. Just before Lynch moved here in 1964, North Philly experienced riots along what is now Cecil B. Moore Avenue that left big scars that hadn't yet healed. Lynch was just an art student who didn't pay too much attention to Philly politics, so he didn't really know the historic significance of all this. He was just absorbing the city as a whole. Lynch said, quote, "The fear, insanity, corruption, filth, despair, violence in the air was so beautiful to me. It gave me a lot of ideas and a certain way of seeing things," end quote.
That's not supposed to be inspiring like that, but I get it.
Well, he's from like Missoula, Montana. So I imagine like growing up, he probably had like this real idyllic life, and like watching Blue Velvet and later movies, you get this idea that he's always looking for the flip side of that coin. And like Philadelphia presented that to him, and in like the most extreme possible way. He was trying to go live in a German art film in Europe, and he couldn't find it. But somewhere around 13th and Callow Hill, he was like close enough.
It's close enough. This is as depressing as a German art film.
Or was like the Itchy and Scratchy when they're like, it was like,
yeah.
I mean, you said like grow, like you mentioned him, like what was probably like for him to go to school in Montana as like a little kid, like what was his teachers like, what were the other students in his class like, how many kids were probably even in his class, you know?
He definitely, it sounds like he stuck out like a sore thumb. He joined the Boy Scouts so that he could quit and say it wasn't for him. Like, he didn't join because he wanted to. He joined.
It was probably
so
the only
could...
thing going on. I mean, what was it? He was born in 46, so it was like the 50s. Like, can you imagine what 1950s, like middle of the country, like was like? It was probably like so boring.
I'm sure it's just like, it's just nature scenes, lots and lots of nature scenes.
And the twist.
The hula hoop hasn't even made its way out there.
We should do a Chubby Checker episode.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
That's a great idea.
All right, save that one.
A feature of all summertime barbecues.
Oh, my God, yes.
So I guess, I mean, we're talking about, you know, the way the city looked, and I think a lot of that influenced Lynch's work, and people have said that Lynch's work is haunted and that the threat of violence is ever present, and this, too, seems to have been influenced by his time in Philadelphia, where he lived in fear of violence. Like we said, he witnessed a man being gunned down outside of his home, and he regularly watched bodies being delivered to the morgue across the street from his house. He lived across the street from the city morgue. So he, like, sits down, you know, gonna work at the old typewriter here in front of my favorite window, and his view is of the city morgue, and I guess ambulances and police and the coroner dropping off bodies.
Pretty wild.
Yeah, he was getting a very specific view of the city. He wasn't like hanging
out. Late '60s Philadelphia, yeah.
Yeah, he was not hanging out with the hippies on South Street. It doesn't appear that he had much crossover with that kind of like, with that resurgence that we talked about in that episode.
I feel like that scene was so small.
It's very specific.
You know what I mean? It's not
people,
like San Francisco. Yeah. It's not like there was like a hippie scene like that. It's like, I feel like most of the city probably was not like that, even if you were like alternative or whatever, you know?
Yeah, clearly David Lynch is in his own like pocket of alternative Philadelphia, and there doesn't seem to be much crossover.
Mm-hmm. David Lynch is a big Bobby Rydell fan.
Yeah.
And Fabian.
Actually.
And Fabian.
Yeah.
He loves those. Big time. He actually loved beach movies. Annette Funicello.
Eraserhead is actually a remake of one of their movies. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's like you were saying, there in Blue Velvet, like, so Blue Velvet is like in like a small town in like suburban, and like in the beginning, it's like they find an ear, somebody's ear in the field, and there's like ants crawling in it, and it like zooms into the ear, and then like down into the underground, and it was like, what's really going on? Like, what's the dirty underbelly of life? And this is like, for Lynch, it was like, oh, Philadelphia.
The answer is Philadelphia, right? Yeah.
Yeah, but that is a recurring thing in all his. Even Twin Peaks is just like, oh, everything's perfect, but it's not what it seems. You know what I mean? Like,
yes,
on the surface, absolutely, everything's great, but
yes, but there's that other side of town. There's the strip club and the secret lives of the murder victims. Yeah, all that stuff. It's very interesting. When the origins are explained to you, you can kind of see the mechanics and the. In the storytelling a little better, too. David Lynch recalled walking around his neighborhood carrying a long piece of wood studded with nails for protection. A police car approached, and the officer inspected the makeshift weapon and simply told Lynch, quote, good for you, buddy, before driving away. And it was in that state of constant terror that David Lynch had a random thought that led him to his first film project. While painting in the Academy's garden, Lynch thought he felt a breeze coming from his canvas. He thought to himself how interesting it would be if his paintings could move like pictures. So in 1967, Lynch made his first short film, Six Men Getting Sick Six Times. He purchased the cheapest 16mm camera that he could and took it over to the Academy's abandoned workspaces. And Lynch spent $150, which was a lot of money to him at the time, and played his film on a loop at the Academy's annual end-of-year exhibit, where it shared the joint first prize. So this installation is, he like has these like sculptures on a wall that are like faces, and they all like have their mouths open like they're gonna vomit, and then he projects a series of still images over the faces, the sculpted faces, and it makes it look like they're vomiting as the pictures progress. So it's like different paintings that he made, and they look like the six men are vomiting, and it happens six times in a row, and then the piece loops over again. So it really goes on forever, as long as
cool. That's a some Yoko Ono shit.
Yeah, it was very avant-garde. It was very strange. And I guess it doesn't seem like much like now. I mean, I went to film school and everybody had a weird film movie and everybody did something strange like this. But I think what's revolutionary is that David Lynch was doing this back in 1967. And he is doing it when there is no film program in the city of Philadelphia. So he went out on his own and he bought this camera and he decided to make he was an art student, he was a painting student, and he decided to make this living painting, this moving painting, which, I mean, obviously, yeah, you go, oh, that's a movie or that's a YouTube video, it's whatever. But there was a crossover that was happening here where, like, people who are having this kind of like, I wish I could, or he's having this kind of thought where he wishes he could bring motion to the things that he is painting to add greater meaning to them. And so he kind of like stumbles into film that way. And it was so radical that they didn't give him the first prize outright. He had to share it with another student who did a more traditional painting.
Can you imagine being the person who tied David Lynch?
I drew a smiley face.
It's a painting of an eye.
I'm sure it was like something super photorealistic, right? Yeah. Lynch made several more short films in Philadelphia, including The Grandmother, which features a neglected little boy growing a grandmother from a seed. But in 1970, yeah. Well, I guess people saw the installation he made, and they were like, oh, make me an installation, and you make film installations now. So, like, that became his thing. So, like, This grandmother,
huge market for that stuff.
Well, I guess his first client was the family of another student at the art academy at PAFA. They were like, "That's so cool, make us one of those." And they hired him to make another installation like that. And he used his wife and a recording of his niece saying the alphabet in a very like angry way or a tormented way. And they made this kind of like semi-animated painted film. and that was the product that he delivered to them, and they were like, great, we love it, and they helped him enter into like short film festivals and stuff. And I guess he took the money from that and made The Grandmother, which features this neglected little boy growing a grandmother from a seed, which it's, you know, it's sweet but sad.
Nona Seeds.
Nona Seeds.
They got him at the home, at the Lowe's on Delaware Avenue. Yeah.
That's really funny. They grow like little, like shriveled up, like puckered faces.
They're always so mean. I don't know.
But in 1971, Lynch moved with his wife and daughter to Los Angeles, where he began studying filmmaking at the AFI Conservatory. So I guess he decided it was time to take this film thing seriously. There, he began work on a new film that would be heavily influenced by his time in Philadelphia, Eraserhead, which we talked a little bit about at the top of the show. Eraserhead. Eraserhead was only a 21-page script, but it turned into an 89-minute movie. Usually these things go like 1 minute to one page, you know, so for having 21 pages of script kind of implies that there's a lot of artsy filling in between those lines of dialogue and stage direction.
We call it the connective tissue in the biz.
Yeah, the connective tissue.
What he directed it too? He wrote it and directed it?
Yes. Lynch filmed at night in some abandoned stables, allowing the production team to set up a camera room, green room, editing room, sets, cafeteria, and bathroom. Which is
took them years to make it, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And this is a style of filmmaking. This is how Trove and I made our movies. You find a location that you can do a lot of things in. You designate certain areas for certain departments, including, you know, the cafeteria so people can
eat. Cafeteria and bathroom.
Yeah, these are big deals. This is like the thing that ensures that a film gets made, is that people can go to the bathroom
and eat.
Yeah. And so he set all this stuff up, and he was kind of like in place with a grant from AFI for $10,000. But eventually the money ran out because it was taking them so long, and Lynch started a paper route delivering the Wall Street Journal to make up the difference. So he would deliver papers and then come to the set, and they would shoot what they could. Lynch was so obsessed with the project that he and his wife separated, and he began living on the set full time.
Damn.
Wow. Yes. Yeah. And I mean, if you've ever watched the movie, it is not like an inviting place to live. It's like being back at 13th and Callow Hill. I don't know why he would do that. Yeah, I don't know. Again, to reference the Stooges episode, it feels like somebody who experienced a trauma living in Philadelphia, and then they just like they went somewhere else and recreated it.
They
tried to take power over it while they were there. Yeah.
Yep. The Three Stooges and David Lynch are pretty much the same.
Last week we found a picture of Connie Mack in Three Stooges. I wonder if we can find a picture of David Lynch in Three Stooges on the internet.
I don't know.
Connie Mack and David Lynch.
And David Lynch.
Connie Mack.
Oh, man. So Eraserhead, for anybody who's never seen the movie, and I'm not necessarily recommending it. Because
I am. If you go in with an open mind, it's very good.
I think it's an intense movie, and I think that people have been told, oh, it's full of a bunch of weird imagery, but it's actually a really intense movie that operates like a painting insofar as it like gets in your brain with a bunch of subconscious feelings that you're maybe not ready to process, or you're maybe not ready for when you sit down to just like watch a movie on your couch. So like I would recommend being in the proper headspace.
Yes.
It's not a Netflix and chill kind of movie, what you're saying.
No, absolutely not.
And you do the old, you pretend to yawn and then you put your arm around the person.
Yeah. One time years ago, there was this girl I was like trying to hook up with, so we watched a movie at my house, and it was Rosemary's Baby. Which
no,
is like,
no, Bierman.
I didn't pick it. So then it's just like, it's just about a lady giving birth to like the devil.
Yeah, really.
And it's just
a real
like,
mood setter.
It kind of.
Which is cool, but
it is
I could
cool,
see.
But
it's a great movie.
I could see how that would not set the mood. You should have watched, like, I don't know.
Anything else.
What's the movie when they, like, go into the pyramids and they take all the stuff out?
The Mummy movies?
The Mummy movies. You should have watched The Mummy movies.
The Mummy. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you should have watched one of those.
Are you talking about The Fifth Element? Maybe you're talking about The Fifth Element.
No. I'm talking about the Mummy 1, Mummy 2, and Mummy 3.
Scorpion King, though? What about Scorpion King?
Yeah. Look.
I don't know. If you're up to the Scorpion King and nothing's happened.
We should pick up artists, a podcast, and be like...
Yeah, I don't know.
Full of hot dating tips from three middle-aged men.
Yeah. Here, rent The Mummy, 1 through 3.
Go to your local free Blockbuster. Okay, so anybody who doesn't know, that was a tangent. So anybody who doesn't know, Eraserhead is the story of Henry, a quiet young man living in a dystopian industrial wasteland. His girlfriend gives birth to a deformed baby, whom she leaves in his care. And this is not a natural deformity. It looks like some kind of like... a lamb fetus or goat fetus wrapped in bandages.
I don't think he's ever said what it's made out of or like what it actually is.
It is disturbing is what it is. It was heavily influenced by the fearful mood Lynch experienced in Philadelphia, and Lynch has called it, quote, the Philadelphia story, end quote. So take for that what you will. But Eraserhead is full of decay and dirt. What little dialogue there is competes for the viewer's attention with a cacophony of scratching, hissing pipes, grinding metals, and loud, angry banging. Sometimes there are sound effects missing where there should be sound effects, like the guy steps in a puddle, Henry steps in a puddle, and there's no sound effect. So it's like, I don't know, it's just disorienting. The film's post-industrial... Yes,
it's very funny, though. Like, it is like, if you look at it as like a weird coming of age movie. Like the guy, he meets his in-laws and they have like a really weird dinner where like the chicken they're eating starts like pouring out black shit. And then like it starts dancing, but it's just like, and like the father-in-law is like smiling and like everything's fine. And it's like, it's very, you could see where he wrote it, that it was like directly coming from him being a father and Philadelphia and all these things.
Yeah, the film's post-industrial, poverty-stricken urban sprawl generates violent, gritty, and bizarre visuals from vacant spaces. So they not just like literally empty spaces, but like this dinner you're describing with the in-laws is like it's empty. There's a lot of air in the room. They're not speaking much, and like I said, there's all these other sounds that are competing for your attention, and this bizarre visual of a dancing chicken dinner appears on the table. It's absurd and disorienting.
Lady in the Radiator singing a song.
Yeah, and that's a whole other thing too. I mean, that the Lady in the Radiator is like a whole metaphor for maybe hope, maybe suicide. It's like, I don't know. It's got some weird visuals too. She's not just a normal woman. She's got like some weird prosthetics in her face, and it forces you to not just listen to the song, but to ask like, why does she look that way? You know, because it's not something natural. It's like something completely strange. And as a result of that strangeness, Eraserhead is as much a Philadelphia movie as maybe Rocky. That's what I'm putting
bold.
Out there.
Wow.
Bold.
Wow. Remember Eraserhead buys that robot?
Eraserhead 4 when he goes to Russia. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Eraserhead stops the Cold War.
Yeah. Yeah, these are classics.
I don't think anyone's ever put that together, Rocky and Eraserhead.
I know that the movie wasn't shot here, but it just like it when you know that that area is where the movie is supposed to be and that is the inspiration for it and you go watch it, you go, "Oh my god, yeah."
Oh,
it's
I
just
get
like,
it. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
They don't shoot much of Always Sunny here either. That's the right vibe, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think was it Rocky III didn't really shoot here either, right?
Yeah, and even in Rocky III,
some of it though.
Even in Rocky movies, they tell you Kensington is South Philly, and they tell you this place is that place. They're mixing it up as well.
They're liars. What you're saying.
Well, movies are like magic tricks, you know. They're just trying to get you to believe what you see.
I don't know if this is too off topic, but yesterday I was on South Street and there was a guy playing three card Monty, and he had lured in like a giant group of people to play with him, and he was like taking all their money. And
how has I don't did know, they like, not I know
like,
that gag?
I was like, this is a trick. You guys are being tricked, and they were like screaming, and he was taking all their money, and I was like, this is like a medieval. Like trick. This is like three card Monty's like from
literally
a like from another
the
time.
The oldest trick in the book.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're pretty much paying that guy to do close up magic tricks. He's gaming you.
He had like a little stand that he was holding in his like left hand, and he had like the three cards like on the little stand he had, and it was just it truly cracked me up. I look at it and him pulling it was an older guy pulling his trick on all these younger guys. And I was like, this is as old as time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't seen something like that in a lot of years. That's crazy.
So I played and didn't win anything.
Look at these idiots. They're all losers. Not like me, though. Not like me.
I got my eye on that card, on that money card.
Yeah, he was walking. He was walking up. He was pulling his Trey was pulling his suspenders out.
Yeah.
He was like walking down the street.
That whole crowd was in on it. They were hustling.
Yeah,
they were all.
It was all.
On
it was all. It was a scam. You. That's art. That's truly art.
Eraserhead was finally finished in 1976. Lynch has said that not a single reviewer of the film understood it in the way he intended. No one gets him. So Lynch tried to get it entered into the Cannes Film Festival, but it was not selected for screening. Reviewers from the New York Film Festival also rejected it, but it was screened at the Los Angeles Film Festival, where it was finally picked up by a distributor. Eraserhead subsequently became popular on the Midnight Movie Underground circuit. It was later called one of the most important midnight movies of the 1970s, along with El Topo, Pink Flamingos, and the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Stanley Kubrick said it was his all-time favorite film.
Wow.
That seeing it at a midnight movie that definitely sets the scene, especially like seeing in the 70s in that world of those kind of movies. That is cool.
But that's like it's not like Rocky Horror where you're like
no, I
know
I get
it's,
that.
It's
but
like oh I'm creeped
like
out.
You're saying like El Topo.
That's more like El Topo.
Or,
yeah.
It's like
thinking of it like that and not like Pink Flamingos, but like like that. It's like oh, it's just a crazy movie to go see at the middle of the night.
And like I also I didn't put this in here, but I had watched a YouTube video of someone describing working with David Lynch at these midnight movie screenings. Lynch owned the print, so if you wanted to screen it, Lynch was coming out there. You know, John Waters was coming out there with their print to screen it. So like for him, the deciding factor of whether or not he would drive his print out there to be in your midnight screening at your theater was what it was screening with. So like, something like Reanimator would be like, oh yeah, I love Reanimator, because he wanted to see Reanimator. So like, he's got to sit through the movie that plays before or after his, you know?
This is like when we toured our movie.
Yeah. But he's like, he's much more successful. He can make demands like that.
Yeah.
Reanimator, also a good movie.
Yeah, Reanimator is a great movie. And I guess this was, you know, part of a scene at the time, traveling around doing the midnight movie thing. In the 1970s, for movies that couldn't get wider release.
Weirder movies.
Lynch said, quote, I saw so many things in Philadelphia I couldn't believe. I saw a grown woman grab her breasts and speak like a baby, complaining that her nipples hurt. This kind of thing will set you back, end quote.
It's Broad and Snyder vibes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Eraserhead is just like, if it's like Broad and Snyder is Eraserhead in real life, basically.
Big
yeah,
Broad and Snyder energy.
So
there's a part in Blue Velvet where I think it's what's her name? Rosalini or no, right? What's her name in that?
Isabella Rosalini?
She's like running away from the evil character, and she's like running down the street naked. And David Lynch said he saw that happen. I don't know if it was in Philly. I assume it was, but he said like that scarred him because it was like this naked woman running down the street, like, or not scarred him, but he always remembered that.
No,
this
I would
like a disturbing image. It probably happened in Philly.
I mean, these are traumatic things he's describing. A guy getting shot, you know, in front of your home. You're like outside having a cigarette or whatever, or you're inside watching your baby, and a guy gets shot in front of your house. It's like a traumatic event. These are,
yeah,
these are crazy things that happened to him that he then like went and put into his art. I definitely believe that. Film critic Greg Olson posits that this time in Philadelphia contrasted starkly with Lynch's childhood in the Pacific Northwest, giving the director a bipolar heaven and hell vision of America, which has subsequently shaped all of his films and television shows.
Nice.
So I guess we'll end with a quote from Lynch when he returned to PAFA for a retrospective. Some of these quotes have been really great. This one's from 2014. Again, this press event. Quote, Philadelphia, I always say, is my biggest inspiration. I went there at the very end of 1965, and I stayed there until 1970. And it was a very sick, corrupt, filthy, fear-ridden city with insanity and fear and negativity in the atmosphere. And at the same time, I really loved the city. There was a mood in Philadelphia that I caught that stayed with me forever. And it's a mood of a kind of a factory town. I fell in love with the architecture, these row houses, and the proportions of these rooms, and the colors they would use, and how it would conjure a mood. And the city really made me dream. It was a beautiful experience. Philadelphia is percolating in me. End quote.
Wow.
That's beautiful.
He gets it.
Yeah, he really gets it.
Send this guy a hat.
Let's go. I want to go to 4th Street Deli with David Lynch.
What do you think David Lynch orders at the 4th Street Deli?
He orders the hot dog, right?
He orders a hot dog under...
They make it there on the spot, right? They stuff him right there.
The hot dog is a sleeper hit of the 4th Street Deli.
It's got the little tips on the ends like a cartoon hot tips. Dog.
There's a rumor that my friend Nick told me that the Terry Gross's husband orders the hot dog from the 4th Street Deli. And we've been obsessed with it ever since.
Yeah. And it's great. And I don't want it to be great because we famously don't get along with Terry Gross. But,
we feud. Yeah.
It's like, what are you going to say?
I got no beef with her husband. I got no beef with her husband.
He's got great taste in hot dogs. We know
yeah,
that.
Yeah. I didn't want to like it, but I had to. I couldn't not. Well, it's so good.
Mm-hmm. It's a good way to end this one.
I think David Lynch used to go to a diner every day and he would eat the same thing. Like, online. He probably went to like.
He went to the Melrose and he had the.
Yeah, he had the
chicken
honey
fingers
mustard,
with honey mustard, the good,
the
good
mustard.
Kind. That's why I love.
I didn't come
so
across
much.
That in my limited research, but that wouldn't surprise me. There, the city had tons of great diners. I know we're down to just a few, but they were.
I think
all
it's a great
place.
Honey mustard. Yeah, tons of great. The honey mustard capital of the country at the time.
Philadelphia,
the,
well known
time,
for its honey mustard.
At the time,
yeah,
at the time.
Yeah, we've not since anymore. Been passed by Phoenix.
Used to be,
I think I read. Right. Now they have the best honey mustard.
We lost our jazz scene. We lost our honey mustard scene. It's, man,
city's going down the tubes. We need another racer head.
And I guess you know Philadelphia stayed with David Lynch and his other work. We talk about it in Blue Velvet, but Twin Peaks. I just watched all of Twin Peaks, and they talk about the Philadelphia office. The FBI agent in the show is dispatched
true.
From the Philadelphia office. The character that David yeah. Lynch plays. Is the director of the Philadelphia branch of the FBI, and it's something that they continued and carried through to the new season a few years ago on Showtime.
Don't they go to? Aren't they in Philadelphia in Fire Walk with Me, where David Bowie? That's supposed to be like the Philadelphia office
yeah.
or whatever.
Yeah, and I know it wasn't intentional, but it looks exactly like the inside of the Public Ledger building on Broad Street above the old Tower Records. It's just like. It looks exactly like the inside of that place.
That place has the green mint color paint.
Yeah, yeah, the and I guess green. And that's what they used in the show. I mean, it's definitely part of the set decoration. So yeah, Philadelphia, inspiring, absurd, weird, David Lynch surreal art.
Yeah, not enough. There's not enough of it.
Well, he's pretty old now, so that Twin Peaks revival was probably the last thing he'll do, but he's got tons of great movies. Actually, the first David Lynch movie I ever saw was Mulholland Drive, which is like kind of sexy, and it's about like Hollywood, and it's like it's like playing with the, you know, ideas of fame and stuff. And so like I watched that movie and I was like, "Wow, that was real trippy." And I was like, "What else has this guy got?" And then I watch Eraserhead for school, and it's like totally disturbing and just absolutely gross and really messes with you. So this guy's all over the place. Go, and I love Twin Peaks.
It.
Yeah, and so I don't know. Put yourself in the right headspace. Don't just jump in. Okay, that's pretty much all there is to know about David Lynch and Eraserhead. You guys got anything you wanna add?
I'm a big fan.
Brian Bierman recommends. Okay, so please check us out. Our website is www.southfellini.com. That's SOUTHFELLINI.com for cool Philly-inspired merch. Check us out on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Follow along and join the conversation. We want to hear from you. What's your favorite David Lynch movie? Who would win in a fight?
Who would win in a fight?
Who would win in a fight? Eraserhead or Rocky? You tell me.
Ooh. Well, Eraserhead can turn his head into a pencil, so.
Yeah. Pretty cool superpower. Look out for new episodes of the podcast every Monday. Stay safe, wash your hands, wear a mask, get a vaccine so we can stop wearing masks.
Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye.
Bye!